Good morning. How are we all doing? Say again. Baruch Hashem, excellent. We're doing BH. BHYY, anybody? Excellent. Yom Yom. Baruch Hashem, Yom Yom. I'm sure we can add more letters as well. Okay. Parsha Mishpatim. Now, how many parshas do you know, generally, that begin with a vav? Give me a few. Vayishlach, another one. Vayigash, Vayetse, Vayeshev, Vayetchanan, Vayechi. There's a lot, right? But there is a lot of attention put on the fact that our parsha begins with a vav. Why is that? It begins Ve'ela Mishpatim, and these are the laws, these are the regulations, and a lot of weight is put on the fact that it begins with a vav because it connects last week's parasha to this week's parasha. That there is a continuity between Har Sinai and the revelation and all these details. But it seems that it's not so unique if we've just listed all the others. What would the difference be for the grammarians in the room? All the cases we just mentioned are different. Vavahipuch, right? That it is a conversive of. All those Vayetse, Vayishlach, Vayechi, Vayeshev are all translated in the King James Bible as and he went. But really, it doesn't have to be and. The Vav in that context shifts a future tense word. Yeshev means he will sit. Vayeshev means he sat. It's really a grammatical shift, a poetic form of the past tense. Ve'ela, there is no tense. It's not a verb. It's and these. It really is the word and. So ve'ela mishpatim. There's another time a parasha begins with ve'ela. Anybody know? It's the first word of the parasha. Ve'ela toldot Yitzchak. Excellent. Another time. I'll give you a clue. It doesn't just begin a parasha. It begins a book. Only five of them. Ve'ela Shemot B'nei Yisrael, give you a clue. Another one, starts another book. Vayikra starts with a Vav, that's also Vav HaHipuch. Okay, what else starts with a Vav that is actually an and? Ve'ela HaDvarim. So Shemot and Dvarim, Toldot Mishpatim. As far as I am aware, and I've not done extensive research, this was it, what we just did now. Those are those that start with the word and. Yeah. Yeah, it is true that it is not unusual, especially if you're looking at the translation that I'm sure many of us are used to that starts with the King James and around then is, and he did, and she did that. There's a huge amount of ands, a lot of vavs. Most of the time, it is the poetic conversive vav that is looking to give a rhetorical past tense. But often you do get just a sentence beginning with and. And these are the laws. Many of us are trained from a young age never to start a sentence with and. I should tell you that when I often break that rule. I'm not a pristine writer, so that's not evidence of anything. But when I'm writing, I often find that and, in certain cases, can actually be quite powerful. And the way that Chazal and commentators since view this vav, this and at the beginning, is not poor writing, but is a profound comment about how the epiphany in religious life is not enough on its own, and that it needs to be accompanied by detail, by living a life. Meaning you can be at Har Sinai and be overwhelmed and inundated by serenity and have a revelation, but if you don't learn to build society with all the laws that come in this week's parasha, it can fall away, it becomes hollow, it becomes a memory, it loses all its substance. Having said that, I should go through some of the things that appear in this week's parasha, and it is an amazing array of laws, legislation, regulations that talk about civil society. This is not, generally speaking, speaking about spiritual life. We're going to get to building the Mishkan and building the epicenter of our sacred rites in the coming weeks. This week is all about fights and solving disputes and theft. We can run through. We've got, well, actually, how does it begin? What are the first rules? Slaves. A very unfortunate translation of the word Eved because of the cultural baggage that that word has, especially in the American context. And for those who are commentators in the modern age, and by modern age I mean from 1850 and on, figuring out how the biblical text deals with endorsed enslavement is a complicated issue. In fact, during the Civil War, the texts that dealt with enslavement were bandied about from the North and the South, mainly for the South, in favor, as you can guess, of slavery in the Americas, in North America. And there's a fascinating book called Exodus and Emancipation, the look about how there are parallels between the stories of the Jewish exodus from Egypt and African-American emancipation in America. But it's also, there's a section in there that speaks about how rabbis dealt with from the pulpit. We always say rabbis shouldn't speak politics from the pulpit. That did not seem to be a rule back then. And you had Southern synagogues saying, you know, don't get involved. You know, we've had a pretty rough life in Europe and we're fine here, so why make a fuss? Confederacy, you know, whatever, it's fine. And the Bible says it's okay. And then you've got rabbis, and there was actually one rabbi in the South, Rabbi David Eichhorn, who stood up and fervently argued against slavery as a deep injustice. He actually said that it is the modern form of Amalek, which we'll get to in a few weeks with Parashat Zachor. And he had to flee the South and he had to come to the North. He was actually a Reform rabbi. He was not an Orthodox rabbi. And he gave a whole sermon about on Shabbat Zachor, what is Amalek in our age? And he said it's slavery, at which point the rabbi not speaking politics from the pulpit rule was invented. And he ran away to the North. But Rav Hirsch, Rav Cook all deal with these passages. In fact, the Hertz Chumash, I don't know if we have copies in the room here, he also speaks about I guess it shouldn't be unfortunate, the word, but Eved doesn't really translate into what became slavery in North America. That was not the institution that is being described here, and it comes across as apologetics to suggest that actually this was redemptive, this was helpful, this was an institution to protect people. That's actually what the Netziv says. He says, in the old world, the servitude system actually gave you protections that if you were in the Wild West of the ancient Near East, which I understand is directionally challenged, but if you're in the Wild East of the ancient Near West, you'd be vulnerable, and actually giving you protection and within a household. And of course, I'm sure you're all going to hear the next sentence that comes out of my mouth for the 15,000th time. If you only had one pillow in the house, who got it? The Eved got it, meaning the descriptions are not of horrific, brutal treatment. The descriptions are that actually, I think the aphorism is, those who acquire an Eved acquire a master, because the standards by which you are held of treatment and respect are incredibly high. But either way, it's a challenging issue because the biblical text does seem to describe this. There are a number of figures, Rav Nachum Rabinovich, who's a Rosh Shiva of Me'el Adumim in Israel. He was also head of Jews College in London, and he lived in Canada for a while, and has a radical reading on a completely separate note about electricity on Shabbos, which we will discuss on a Shabbos afternoon after Pesach in our summer contemporary halacha pre-mincha Shabbos afternoon series, titled To Be Determined. That was very catchy. And he has a radical view about electricity on Shabbos, but he also suggests that actually the Torah it was a product of its day. HaKadosh Baruch Hu dictated this to Moshe, not in a vacuum, not in the ether, but in the year, blunk-de-blunk, 3,000 years ago, which involved dealing with the issues of the time. And Maimonides, the Rambam, deals with this all the time. He says that the whole institution of Korbanot was to do what? Why do we have Korbanot? Let me take a step back before we say, why do we have Korbanot? We have Korbanot. In Jewish life, we're going to get to this in Vayikra and elsewhere. We've seen this practiced by the Avot, that there are sacrifices. Animals are taken and they're slaughtered. Some are eaten, some are not. They're burned on an altar. What potential theological issues might one raise with such an institution, with sacrifices? We used to it. We talk about it all the time. We say Korbanot every morning in Shacharis, or at least we kind of turn the pages past them. So what is the institution? What problems does it pose theologically? Okay, Tsar Balei Chaim, we'll come to that in this week's parasha. Interesting. The animals are in pain. That's true, but what else would come across Tsar Balei Chaim if that's true?
Eating food,
right? Meaning you're right, killing them hurts for sacrifices, killing them to eat also, imagine, hurts them. So we'll have to talk about inflicting pain on animals, but that could be a problem. That's more of an ethical problem, let's say. Theologically, what might be the problem with sacrifices?
That the Goyim did it.
Interesting, meaning it's not unique.
They used to have sacrifices, so they would sacrifice to their gods.
Interesting. And what's the theological problem there? That we're copying others? Or that...
Yes.
What do you mean, yes?
Yeah, we're copying the
good. Oh, interesting. Meaning chukat akum. Which is interesting, because Maimonides, the Rambam, suggests actually it's precisely to copy them in some way that we do it. The problem, the larger theological problem, I think, because others did it, was not that others did it, but why did others do it? Why were the other cults?
To appease
God. The whole system is that there's a notion that this being needs me to kill an animal to make it feel better, or to somehow distract it from harming other people. It's such a strange dynamic. That's why others did it. And the problem was that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this being who is not material, that reaches down into the cosmos to free the Jews from Egypt, now wants me to kill a goat and spill blood on the floor and spritz it on the top and spritz it on the bottom one time and seven times to make him. Why? This is crazy, right? Theologically, why do you need this behavior? And that's the potential problem. There are obviously solutions. Maimonides, the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide to Perplex, says the whole point of Korbanot was to wean the Jews off these foreign practices. They lived in a world in which that was how gods were served. If you didn't sacrifice, it wasn't worship. It wasn't religion. It wasn't God. And had they come to Har Sinai and God says, no sacrifices, I don't need it, I don't want it, they would have said, what kind of God are you? This doesn't make any sense to you. You don't want sacrifices? I don't get it. And it was set up to wean off, which then raises a fundamental question about the future. So in the eschatological visions, which is just a posh way to say the end of days, if we're thinking about the end of days and messianic age, are there going to be sacrifices? According to Maimonides' logic, should there be?
No.
We don't do it anymore. We see it as somewhat obscene in some ways to just slaughter animals for the sake of it. And there are views that suggest in the messianic age, however that comes to be, there will not be korbanot. There will be korban mincha, which is really baked goods, which doesn't involve pain, doesn't seem obscene, there's no blood, it doesn't seem vicious, it's not cultish. That's one view that feeds off Maimonides. Now, as I was speaking, I was very conscious to leave some mental breadcrumbs to figure out how on earth we were talking about this, which is that sometimes there are commentators who view things in the Torah as necessary for the age that are to be weaned off, right? Korbanot for Maimonides are not intrinsically meaningful. Again, there is a huge pushback to Maimonides. Ramban, Nachmanides, and others say, you have just written off one-fifth of the Torah, at least. You just said the book of Vayikra was basically needed for the time, but come the end of days, come the Messianic age, we're going to schluff for, you know, a fifth of the year during the laning, maybe more, but with good reason for a fifth of the year, because you've just said that it's no longer relevant. So why should I learn Kodshim now? It's never coming back, right? So that's the critique to the Rambam, to Maimonides in that context, which again, he would have an answer for, but that's his argument. Now, in our context, one moment, otherwise I'm going to lose the Hansel and Gretel trail back. In our context, Rav Rabinovich and Rav Hirsch to some extent, and Rabbi Sachs has a piece about this as well, suggesting that it was needed for the age. The systems of enslavement in the ancient world were brutal. They were brutal. They were not what is described in our parsha. They were horrific. Anyone see Gladiator?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the best example. I don't know how historical it is, but the way that gladiators were treated, which were essentially they were enslaved and then forced to fight for others' entertainment. There's a wonderfully, well... pathetic isn't the right word. It produces pathos, but it's not pathetic. When he wins in the arena and throws the sword out and says, are you not entertained? This figure who was the leader of armies and legions is now fighting for other people's entertainment at the risk of his own life. That's what slavery was at its best, because there at least you had a chance of survival and you could work your way up to freedom. And here the Torah is legislating how those systems should work with the hopes that people will come to see the injustice of the institution and it will be weaned off. That's how other people have suggested that, yeah, there are systems here that by our standards, it's not good enough to turn around and say, well, it wasn't as bad as it was in the South. It wasn't as bad as it was in the ancient world. That's perfection. That's the word of God. It wasn't as bad as. That doesn't work. The only way that humanity and civilization could be weaned off the need for this institution. That's the argument they've given, which of course then raises the issue. So now you've written off another part of the Torah as being pertinent. And the pushback could of course be there are eternal lessons about dignity and civility and respect and ethics embedded in these passages that doesn't need to be brought into lived life to be gleaned. Did I see a few hands? So that's the question, and it's widely debated, because Maimonides has a piece, Rav Kook has a piece that suggests maybe there won't be any korbanot. There's a wide debate, but then again, everything about the Messianic age is debated. Are we going to have bodies? I mean, that's pretty central to who we are at the moment. That's debated. What is the Messianic age as opposed to Olam Haba? When we talk about
Rambam's version of the Messianic age is we have a party, Mashiach comes, we go to work next day.
Yeah, right. So there are varied views. Rambam, Maimonides says, right at the end of his Mishneh Torah, there is no difference between now and the Messianic age apart from the fact that we won't be under the hegemony of other nations, which one could reasonably claim the state of Israel is an independent nation. Of course, it's dependent in large measure on American aid and others, but that's just how national government works. So it's hard to debate what the future will look like. But yes, there have been others in the 18th century who tried to go up onto Temple Mount and offer Korbanot to institute the third temple era. So the basic answer to this question is, who knows? I guess we'll figure it out when it comes in on the white donkey, which is the best I can do for this as well. Yeah. So prayer is an interesting question, which I guess we can put on hold till Va'et Chanan, which will be a while till we get there. But prayer, in theory, was instituted. There's a debate among the sages whether it was instituted to replace the Korbanot or separately by the patriarchs. So we'll put that on hold. Let's assume prayer will continue. Let's assume. There's a debate we'll get to in Parashat Tzav Vayikra about the Korban Todah and about whether universally it's agreed that the Korban Todah would exist. And then the question is, well, why would I need to be grateful for some salvation in a perfect world? It'll be perfection. We can talk about that at the time. Okay, so we've got Avadim at the beginning. We've got fathers selling their own daughters. There's a piece on Aleph Beta, Rabbi David Foreman, who's got an interesting reading on that scene. You should feel free to take a look. We deal with the laws of assault of animals in our possession that gore others, which in some extended way could apply to automatic cars in some future world. If I've got a car that's a driverless car and it malfunctions and it hits someone, if it does it three times, I think there's an issue with your car. But say again, you have to stone it. You have to throw it off a cliff and you have to stone the car. Right, but these, broadly speaking, again, these ancient debates about sheep and oxen are used to apply to the modern world. Another question about electricity we'll get to in that Shiron Shabbos once I've prepared it and figured out what we'll talk about. But one question is, if I just speak to a machine, I haven't touched anything, I haven't done anything, I just say, I'm wary to do it in case this cuts off the recording, but this is not an Amazon product. If I say, Alexa, what's the weather today? Have I done it? And then it tells me the weather. Now I know when I'm going to shul, should I wear my coat? Should I wear my hat? I've not done anything. It was on. So what's the problem? The recording should not cut off at that point. We'll talk more about it. One source that's suggested is that actually the Gemara says, if I've got an ox and I tell it to plow and it does it on Shabbos, that's a malacha. because speaking, motivating something to happen through speech is the same as doing it. So what might have thought is that I don't really plow that often, I don't have an ox, becomes pertinent again because of the dynamics of the case. So many of these cases seem ancient, but they're actually quite relevant. There is a lot about loans in this week's parasha, about seduction, about witchcraft and wizardry, and whether that's permitted or not. In fact, anyone know what fan fiction is? Familiar with that term? So fan fiction, let's put it this way. People familiar with fiction? Okay. So fiction can get a lot of fans. Harry Potter, as the example that's coming to mind, has a lot of fans. People get very excited about this whole world, this universe that's been created in their imagination. And they have questions about, well, what... There was a question posed to J.K. Rowling, who wrote Harry Potter. Are there any Jews in Hogwarts? And what does she say? She said yes, Alex Goldstein. And he does come up in a number of the books. I think it's Alex, maybe something else. Goldstein comes and says, yes, he's Jewish. So then you've got all the, in England, the Jews in Golders Green, which is kind of the more observant neighborhood, I guess, here. Well, I don't know if they read it in the places I'm thinking of. So in Hendon they read it. But either way, you have these Jews say, hold on a minute, if he's Jewish, is he Orthodox? Is he Reform? And then somebody said, I need to write some fan fiction. So there was somebody who wrote about four chapters of Alex Goldstein's application process. He got the letter from the owl, and then he went to his rabbi and says, there's a prohibition on magic. I can't do kishuf. Am I allowed to go to Hogwarts? Exactly. It's fun. It's fan fiction. Either way. So kishuf is prohibited. Magic, witchcraft is prohibited, which again then launches the question, well, hold on a minute, if it's prohibited, is it real? Is the biblical text suggesting that there is such a thing as magic and we shouldn't do it? Now, if you're a hyper-rationalist, let's say Maimonides the Rambam, what do you think about magic?
Doesn't exist.
So why is there a prohibition?
Piffle.
Say again?
Piffle.
Piffle? Is that an American term? Right, I thought it was English. It just means rubbish, right? It means meaningless. So what's the prohibition? So the Chartumim, we have the necromancers in Egypt who seem to perform mini miracles, let's say. Was that real? Well, if anyone saw the Prince of Egypt, the Pixar version, you'll know it wasn't, right? But that's just their version. Meaning Moses turned the Nile to blood, well, God did through Moses, and then the Egyptians on the boat with Pharaoh need to reproduce it. So they get this bowl of water and they go, ooh, and they sprinkle some red powder in it and it turns red. And that's the way they accounted that it wasn't real. And presumably Maimonides would have felt the same way. That, no, of course this isn't real. So what's the prohibition if it's not real? Why can't I do it? Why am I being told I can't do something that can't be done? Because it's deception. That's his argument, that actually you're engaging in what is now called illusionism, right? Magicians go around there, they know that nobody believes in magic, so they call themselves illusionists. And they say, look, you know we can't perform miracles of magic, but I'm going to make you think I can, and that's going to impress you. And they do that. There are figures who do that all the time. And for the Maimonides, there's no such thing as kishuf. The necromancers in Egypt couldn't do magic. The whole prohibition is you shouldn't be engaging in stuff that makes yourself look like you're doing these things. Again, the Nachmanides, the Vilna Gaon, push back on Maimonides. In fact, the Vilna Gaon has a little piece here when it comes to kishuf, and Maimonides says it doesn't exist. The Vilna Gaon says, Rambam has been corrupted by philosophy. He says, Maimonides has read too much, Aristotle has been corrupted, but of course it existed. Look at the biblical text. God split an ocean, right? You don't think there are powers in the world beyond what we can see, beyond which the rational mind can comprehend? And we live in an age in which most people feel, yeah, that their magic doesn't really exist. We enjoy Harry Potter because it engages a nostalgic, romantic part of our brain, but it's not real. Either way, kishuf comes up, the prohibition on kishuf. Bestiality comes up as a prohibition, apostasy. And then there is the central tenet to be not to oppress the ger, which will be our main passage today once we get there. We talk about the importance of judges having integrity. As you get from here, this is a mass of law. Last week, how many laws were we given at Har Sinai? 10, right? There are a few more in the parasha, but there are 10 commandments. And now we have just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. It's an explosion of legislation here. Ilam Mishpatim. These are the civil duties of how to run a society. So we have, and then we have the helping your enemy's animal. You're walking along the street, your enemy's animal is underneath a load. We have to help. What is the point of that law?
You should hate somebody. Even if you hate somebody, you should help.
So that is one of the views of reading this, absolutely. Why tell me it's my enemy's animal? Just tell me there's an animal on the road, I should help. It's a person. We're being told it's an enemy, precisely. The Rabbeinu Bach and others make this point, that we're being told that precisely when it's your enemy, you have to help, because the Torah wants you to become closer. In fact, Tuesday, what day are we today? We're Thursday. Next Tuesday evening will be the monthly Shir, which will be the final installment of the winter series, in which we will suggest that the whole point of Torah is Netivot Shalom, is to achieve peace, and this is one of the examples. That there is a rule that if your enemy's animal is in pain, you have to help, because the Torah wants you to get close to your enemy. That's why the enemy is used as an example. What's the other way to read this? Maimonides read.
Even if you have in your mind good reason to hate someone, don't take it out on his animal.
Right, back to Tzar Balei Chaim. This is the way Maimonides and other reads. It says, even if it's your enemy, even if you don't want to help, fine. So if his car broke down, leave him. But there's an animal in pain here. And don't think, I don't like that guy. Sorry, mule, you're on your own. There's a creature of God that's in pain. It's on the floor. It needs help. So you should help your enemy's animal. Even, and he doesn't say, your enemy's your enemy. That's fine. But you should help the animal. And Tzar Balei Chaim, the prohibition on inflicting pain on animals, is also brought up to this day in a number of different ways. There was a question posed to one of the medieval figures about hunting, about whether hunting is permissible for Jews. Which one can use in the context of all sorts of things, of Jewish views on gun control or Second Amendment rights. You could talk about Jewish views of harming animals, and he basically comes down and says hunting for the sake of hunting, meaning real animals, he basically says it's not a Jewish thing to do. Of course, there are people who can disagree with that, but that was his view. And his argument was, because what you're doing is you're saying, to entertain myself, I'm going to hurt other things. And as many of you know, you shoot an animal, you can't eat it. It has to be shechted to be kosher. So there's a discussion about that. There's another context in which animals may be harmed for our use. What would that be? Not just for entertainment.
Clothes.
What about clothes? In fact, when we get new clothes, we say the brach of Shechianu, with one exception. Not just shoes. Leather shoes, right? You have leather, you don't say Shechianu. Even though it's new and expensive and noble and majestic, something died for this. So you don't say Shechianu on it. When else can animals be used for human cases, not just for clothes or entertainment?
Medical experiments.
Oh, so transport, medical experiments. I'll come to that in a moment. Medical experiments all the time. You have had protests against medical experimentation on animals for I don't know if centuries is right, but at least a century. It used to be called vivisection. I mentioned this earlier in the year. Vivisection just means cutting up, and that used to be what medical experimentation on animals were called. There were people who were dead against it. But in the Jewish context, again, Tzar Balei Chaim is not that animals are people and have the rights of people, but we shouldn't inflict harm on them unless it is for good reason. And then as soon as you've got that loophole, the question is, well, what's good reason? Clothing is a good reason. Medical cures are a good reason. So should entertainment be a good reason? Meaning human beings, are we entitled to entertainment in life? Generally.
Yes.
Yeah. Is it good for human beings to feel refreshed and relaxed and entertained and optimistic? Yeah. Mental health is a centrally important thing. And one way is to attend mental health, to make sure that one's in a good mood and entertained. You know, some of you recommend somebody go for a hike because they enjoy looking at nature. Some of them watch a movie to chill out for a bit. So why shouldn't I, in the days before television, you know, in the 1300s, you're stressed out and you want them to relax. You can't say, well, go and put on Netflix. So what do? Go watch a dog fight. Go watch something. Meaning, if I'm going to watch a fight, do I have to watch a person fighting or can I watch an animal fight? This has been a fascinating evolution through the ages about what has been deemed a good reason for people to use animals. Again, in our age, when you've got television, often when there are movies that involve animals, I remember just there was a movie, War Horse. Anyone see War Horse?
No.
It was a big play. I can't remember if the play or the movie came first, but I think there was a novel as well. Say again? The play came first, and it follows the journey of a horse through World War I, which is an odd angle to take on World War I. But the horse was used by both sides in the war, and it followed the journey back to the farm he came from, and he meets his owner from a field back in England. It's very moving, and it was innovative the way the play was, people dressed up either way. At the beginning of the movie, it says no animal was harmed in the making of this movie, because they obviously followed the psuk of this medieval rabbi, that even for entertainment purposes. And they've got the useful CGI, so they don't have to actually harm animals. Either way, Tzar Balei Chaim is there. Now, the question we may raise before is, well, why is it prohibited? Do animals have rights not to be harmed? Because if that's true...
They have a union.
They do have a union. The culinary union, I'm told. Didn't mean to get political there. Just show you that I've been watching the news. I don't even know what that is. I'm English. But I heard they wield a lot of power in Nevada. Or Nevada. I don't know what it's called. I also know Michelle Obama said it wrong. That was, I don't know, 10 years ago. She said Nevada or Nevada, and it was the wrong one, and they all got very offended. What is it? Nevada?
Nevada?
Nevada. All right. I'm sure the French get irritated when we say Paris as well. It's Paris. Okay. Oh, I didn't leave breadcrumbs. Why are we talking about this? You asking me? Oh, that's what we're talking about. Right. Yes, can we harm animals? They have a union. Thank you. You took me off. That was you. So why can't we harm animals? Let me put it this way. If they have a right not to be harmed, what should none of us be doing?
Eating
animals that we have killed. If they have a right not to be harmed, so you find something dead, fine. But we shouldn't be able to kill animals. And that's precisely the argument made by Nachmanides, the Ramban. Because Maimonides says, why can't we harm animals? Because they feel pain. They feel pain. He says, you look at this, he says, this actually comes out a number of laws. You can't kill a mother and a calf on the same day. It's called Oto Ve'et Beno, it and its child. You can't kill on the same day. That'll come up in Vayikra. And Maimonides says, why? Because it's heartless. You can't kill a kid in front of its mother. You could say, okay, so tomorrow it's all better, like meaning just then it's a problem. But either way, that's it. And he says, and all these rules, Tzar Balei Chaim, applies, we shouldn't be harming animals. And Nachmanides says, well, Maimonides, if you're serious about this, you should become a vegetarian pretty quick, and you shouldn't be hurting animals. So why should we not be hurting animals? Ramban says, because it contributes to a vicious character. And really, we shouldn't be harming animals, not because the animals per se have rights. They are creatures. But lots of plants are creatures of God too. They are living things. I can't measure pain on a plant. And now we may have the capacity to measure pain in an animal. But he says it's not. It's about us as people not becoming vicious and hostile and violent. And that's why we shouldn't be harming things. That's his. Nachmanides. Either way, then we have the parasha. We get to Chamishi. We talk about Shemitah. We talk about the Shalosh Regalim. Korbanot come up in a slight. Reference Bikurim. Then we have right at the end the two most famous words that the Jews say in response to Revelation. Naaseh v'nishma. It's not said at Har Sinai, it's said later at the end of this week's parsha. They say Naaseh v'nishma, which means we will do and we will listen. Okay, what does that mean? What is odd about that statement? You would have thought you'd say yes, tell us what you want and then we'll do it. Right? People get irritated with me. I say people, okay, my wife gets irritated with me when she's trying to tell me to do something. Okay, I'll go, I haven't told you what I need you to do yet. So I know what you mean, I'll figure it out. Say, no, wait, I'll give you all the instructions and then do, and then I won't be irritated with how you've done it. So why the Jewish people? Hashem says, I'm going to give you, we will do. Wait, I'm in the middle of speaking. Let me tell you what. So what on earth does this phrase mean? We will do and we will listen. Rabbi Sachs has a piece this week, his Covenant Conversation. If you take a look every week, you'll see it. If not, it's a great piece. Have a look where he describes the multiple ways that this has been read. Naaseh v'nishma, we will do and we will listen. What is the most famous way that this has been read? What does this suggest, this order? We will do and we will listen.
Regardless what you say, we will do what you...
It's a signal of devotion, right? That whatever you want, meaning we're not going to decide after we've listened to you whether we will do it. We will do whatever you want. Now tell us what it is. It's just a signal up front that we're committed, we're in, and now you tell us what to do. That's one way it's been read. Another way it's been read is that we will do in a way that shows we're listening. We're not just going to do it, you know, all right, we'll get it done, but we'll do it with a sense of commitment, devotion to what we're trying to achieve. It won't just be lip service. That's one way it's been read. It's also been read by some as we will do everything you've said so far, v'nishma, and we'll listen to everything you say in the future. It's not just that we're happy with what you've said so far, but it's actually an eternal commitment. That's another way it's been read. The Akedah Yitzchak, Rabbi Isaac Arama of Italy, the medieval period, suggests that actually the suggestion here is that we will do it and understand by doing it. One example might be, anyone play a musical instrument here? Not right now, but anyone capable of playing an instrument? I'm not going to call on you. Okay, partially. Sounds like you play it as well as I do. What instrument?
Guitar.
I learned to play guitar. I could get through the James Bond routine and maybe Mission Impossible. I don't remember what they were. I don't know why they taught us that first. I got that and then the guitar broke. That was the end of that. I played recorder for a little bit because everybody did that in elementary school. And I played keyboard until my teacher said I was rubbish. And that was the end of that. Yes, but music is one of those disciplines that you cannot learn from reading a book, right? You can't say, okay, get me a book on how to play guitar. I've never seen a guitar in my life. I think maybe there's an episode of Friends, actually, when one of the characters insists on teaching the other one to play guitar without a guitar. Or maybe it's a keyboard. They just do it on the table. And it's very frustrating. I need to do it to understand how it works. You need to get fluid. Experience. And here the suggestion of Yitzchak Arama is, they're saying, Naseh v'nishma, we'll do it, and that's how we'll understand what we're doing. And in fact, colleague isn't the right word because they're far more senior than I am, but a rabbinic senior colleague of mine said that he was at a funeral at one point. He was, what's the word? Thank you. Officiating at the funeral. And it was somewhat tragic circumstances, and the bereaved family member just wasn't ready for all this ritual that seems to justify and endorse what happened. And after the burial, they're standing at the kever, and he says, okay, we're going to say Tziduk Hadin now, which is essentially a confession to God that what you've done is just and you are the ultimate judge. And he said, he was doing pastorally the right thing by explaining what we're about to do, and said, we're about to say Tziduk Hadin, which is justifying the judgment and saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that you're the ultimate judge. And this grieving figure turned to him and said, I'm not ready to say that. I just can't say that. And as a rabbi, you're somewhat stuck, meaning ritually that's what you do now. And he said that sometimes the most effective things are things that come out just spur of the moment. You don't plan. You can plan for days something and it doesn't work. And sometimes just spur of the moment, you say something and somebody finds that it resonates. And he said, well, maybe you can't feel it right now. How about we do it now and we understand it later? And this figure said, okay, that I can do. Meaning if I'm just going to have to do it and I don't have to feel it, that's okay. And maybe that's to some degree a Naseh v'nishma. We'll do it even if we don't feel it. Even if it doesn't resonate with me right now, I have a commitment that this is the way that I run my life. This is the traditions that have run society for generations. I'm going to do it. Naseh. V'nishma, even if the understanding comes later. That's one suggestion. But Rabbi Sachs has an interesting reading where he finishes and he says, Naseh v'nishma is suggesting that Naseh, we will all do it. And how do you, when you all do it, it's all being done the same way. We'll all do it in one way. We'll all be universal. V'nishma, but the understanding is separate. The way that it resonates for us, the way that we make meaning out of it, there's freedom to think about things differently. What does Shabbat mean to you? What does Kashrus mean to you? The way that Jews have run their lives, we all do the same thing. But how we feel about it can be radically different, and that's being endorsed here. We don't have to all think in a monolithic way about Jewish life. We all have to do the same thing, because that's the way that law works. But the way that it resonates with us, the way that it inspires us, the way that it gets us up in the morning and drives us is something that we have the flexibility. Naaseh, we'll all do it, v'nishma, and we'll all understand it in the way that makes sense, which is why over the centuries you'll have different ways of resonating kilayim. As one example, we'll come to in Vayikra and again later, we can't have interwoven of wool and linen. Why? Yeah, it's a chok. So suggestion is the Torah doesn't exactly say why, but if you look through history, at different moments, different suggestions have been promoted. Why? And we'll get to that when we get to Vayikra, but that's just an example. Okay, to our pasuk, because we have less than a minute. So, v'ger lo tonev lo techalatzenu. This is a central tenet in this week's parasha, and actually having the instruction to love the ger comes up almost more times than any other mitzvah in the Torah.
Most repeated.
It is the most repeated mitzvah in the Torah. Hafta et hager. Here it doesn't say hafta. It says, v'ger lo tonev lo techalatzenu, and the ger you should not oppress or harass, ki gerim hayitem ben Mitzrayim, because you were gerim in the land of Egypt. Question one, what does that mean, because you were gerim in the land of Egypt? Why is that relevant? Meaning, give me a law. I have to say, because you were, what's that got to do with it? Don't oppress the ger. Now, you may have noticed I've not translated that word yet. What does ger mean?
Stranger.
Or convert. Traditionally, ger is used to mean convert. And then it says, ki gerim hayitem ben Mitzrayim, because you were gerim in the land of Egypt. So can it mean convert in this context?
No.
Interesting. So the Ora Chaim says yes. Most people, correct, agree. But the Ora Chaim says in Egypt, the Jews all fell into idolatry. They all started worshipping. In fact, the Netziv has a scathing understanding of Jewish life in Egypt. They didn't want to leave. It wasn't just they were used to their daily lives, but they had become enmeshed in Egyptian culture. And this idea that there is a God in a bush in a desert that doesn't burn and he wants us to leave, that's not. I'm praying to the gods here. I'm trying to get out of it. Yes, freedom I'm on board with. This different culture, this new, we've got a system. The Netziv has that reading. And the Ora Chaim says the Jews needed to essentially convert to Judaism at that time, which is precisely why we're saying, don't throw at a ger, you know, memories of a previous life and make them feel small or cast aside, because you come from the same background. That's Ora Chaim's reading. The general reading here, Rashi's in the next box, Kol Lashon Ger Adam Shlo Nolod Ba'ota Medina. I love this Rashi every time. In America, the definition of a ger, he says, is a person that is not born in that country. El Abam Medina Acheret Lagur Sham, it comes from another country to live there. What's the one word for that?
Immigrant.
Good morning. I know I don't get the sympathies of the usual immigration story. Actually, when I was a graduate student in Chicago, which, for the record, I still am. When I started as a graduate student in Chicago, and they don't pay graduate students incredibly well, and there was a fund. What is the fund for the Jewish fund that gives towards immigration?
Hyatt.
They had a grant for graduate students of immigrants. And you had to write a personal essay about your story of immigration. And I just thought, I don't think my story is going to cut it. I came from an oppressive life in the difficult city of London where I couldn't make it. And I flew here quite comfortably on British Airways. And I studied beautifully in Yeshiva University. And I don't think it pulled anyone's heartstrings. So I don't fit the general profile of an immigrant, but some of you may be immigrants. Some of you may have been born in another country, and some of you may associate or know people who are immigrants and associate with the traditional immigrant story of fleeing persecution. But the suggestion by a number of the commentaries here is actually immigration as an issue, and I'm not getting political for the record, immigration here, the suggestion is not just people who have fled persecution. This is not just refugees. But immigrants generally, which I would be included in, and the suggestion that's foreknown others is, they don't get the culture. Again, England and America, the cultures are relatively similar, and with the gift of technology and media, it's pretty overlapped. But occasionally I'll say things, words, or I'll be told words that I don't get the context for. If my kid is crying a lot and I say, oh, where's the dummy? Some people think I'm being quite rude about my child. But I'm looking for a passy that in England is called a dummy. Because it makes them dumb, meaning makes them quiet. A passive, you're pacifying a kid. It's not that much better. It just sounds cuter. So there are small things here and there. Again, that's not a catastrophe. There are some words that are catastrophically different meanings that I will not go through on a recording or ever in public. Maybe on Purim, who knows? See what you can get out of me. But the suggestion is that when people are unfamiliar with a culture, one has to be incredibly sensitive to them, and this actually comes up in Megillat Rut, she being an immigrant from Moab, and there's a suggestion that her grammar is bad, actually, and Naomi, her mother-in-law, is very sensitive about how to help her learn Hebrew. We can talk about that in Megillat Rut, because it's difficult when you come from another place to feel settled. And the Siftei Chachamim says, actually, this is a deeply Jewish characteristic, not that it's aspirational, we should all aspire to be immigrants, but Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov all come from an immigration background. They move from one place to the next. Now, I had to quote the Malbim because obviously you have to quote the Malbim, but the Malbim suggests that this shouldn't just be a Jewish trait, this should be a deeply human trait, to feel like an immigrant. Why? Because at base, what is our identity? His suggestion is, our identity is our souls. Where do our souls live? What is the haven of souls? That was the clue, haven. Heaven, right? Meaning none of us are really native to the material world, is the Malbim suggestion. So we should all feel out of place, unrooted, somehow culturally dissonant, and driven on a mission, not rooted to the ground. That's the suggestion here. And actually, generosity to the immigrant awakens in each of us. Politicians in America like speaking about that being American is, America is an immigrant story. And America is a nation of immigrants, but really the world is, the species of humanity is a species of immigrants in that we are all somehow refugees from a higher plane, down here driven by a mission to help others, not just to build our own homes. That's the suggestion of the Malbim and others. Now, in the next box, oh, we need to finish the pasuk. Call two pasuk. To Psukim. Kol almanavi atom lo ta'anun. Any widow and orphan you shall not ta'anun oppress. Ta'anun in the plural. You, plural, shall not oppress. Im ane ta'ane oto. And if you, singular, shall oppress oto, translate oto, him. Who's him? We just said you shall not oppress the widower or the orphan in big terms, plural. But if you, singular, oppress him,
the orphan.
What happened to the widower?
That's the mother of the orphan.
Right. So what happened to her? Ki imsau ki tzak elai, because if he cries out to me, shema ishma tzakato, I will hear his cry. So there are a number of questions. Again, if we put this pasuk under pressure, we're going to get a lot of questions about the shift from plural to singular, from mother and child, or general, widows and orphans, to him. How does that shift take place? And there's also something in this pasuk that arises as somewhat of a pattern. What pattern arises in that pasuk, that last pasuk? Doublings, right? Aner ta aner, tzaok yitzak, shma ishma. That is very uncommon in the Torah. Occasionally you'll have the repetition, it's seen as an intensification of the verb. Shmar tishma, you shall surely guard. But to have three in a row is very unusual. So the number of questions about this. First question was still on Gerim. Why are we being warned to be nice to the immigrant? We had one suggestion that at root, that's what we all are at some fundamental spiritual sense. The Rabbeinu Bachya says, "Ki gerim hayitem ben Mitzrayim, you were immigrants or you were foreign." And by the way, the translation stranger is the usual translation of the word ger, a stranger. In the, maybe it's just me, but in colloquial language now, to call someone a stranger is less accurate because it has connotations, right? What do we tell kids? don't talk to strangers. If I said to my children, don't talk to foreigners, that would have a very different vibe, right? So maybe that's what we should get as a foreigner, someone from another place. It's not a stranger. Stranger has that connotation of being strange. Meaning even the term alien, which is used all the time in legal terms. I was a resident. Was I resident alien? Yes, I was, I guess. I've got rid of the antenna since. But I was a resident alien on a green card. That's just what it's called. My grandfather had alien stamped in his documentation when he came to England. Again, it had legal ramifications then. But now again, to call someone alien means that they are at odds. And stranger that they are strange. So maybe foreigner is the best translation again. So when we say, Ki gerem hayitem be Mitzrayim, that we were foreign in the land of Egypt. We were from elsewhere. So why is that pertinent? So the Rabbeinu Bachya says it's pertinent because God is giving an example of the power that these people wield. Meaning you were gerem in the land of Egypt. You were foreign there. People underestimated you. You were vulnerable. You were sidelined. You were enslaved. You were exploited. And what happened? They thought, these guys have got no power. They thought, they're under our boot. No one can help them. And who helped them? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, people think that no one's going to fight for them. Look at the last line. Our last line of Rabbeinu Bachya, third box, first source, last line. Al tachshov, do not think, she'ein lo misha yarivet rivo, that this figure has no one who will fight their fight, who will keep, defend their corner, ki anihu harav et rivo, because it is me that fights for them, v'ha'osen nekamah b'oshkav, and I am the one who wreaks vengeance for their exploitation. HaKadosh Baruch is saying, for the people who don't have friends, I'm their friend. People who have people in high places, the people in high places can help them. People who don't have people in high places, they got the being in the high place. And how do I prove to you that that's true? Ki gerem hayitem b'Mitzrayim. Just look at your experience. You had no one on your side, and it was precisely because of that that I intervened. It's not because you're special. It's not because the Jewish genetic code summoned me out of heaven to come and save you. It's because you were vulnerable and you were exploited and no one was standing up for you. That's why I intervened. And now you should understand that you shouldn't visit on the vulnerable. You shouldn't make victims out of people, because it is precisely that characteristic that drew me out of heaven to help you. So that is how to run society. That's Rabbeinu Bachya. Shadal, Rav Shlomo David Lozato, actually says that Gerem Hayitem B'Mitzrayim, the suggestion, Rabbi Sacks also has a piece about it. They're saying the whole purpose of being in Egypt, what was the purpose of going down to Egypt? Why did God make us do that? We can talk about this more in Pesach. There's a lot of views about this. But the fundamental suggestion of Shadal and Rabbi Sacks and others is... say again?
So he could rescue us.
So that's one view. We'll add that to the list for Pesach. Their suggestion is, and it's hard to swallow, is that to give us empathy, to make us empathetic as a people. That if we have not been through that kind of pain and alienation and torment, we would by definition not have empathy for those who are going through that. And that's not easy, as I say. That's hard to swallow. Okay, so you're telling me 200 years worth of people had to die in sand pits so that we as a nation would feel sorry for other people? It's harsh. And I can't push back against it. Whenever, from personal experience, I've undergone something that's painful or difficult or challenging, and again, this isn't recommended as a word of comfort to others unless they want to hear it, is that I can't justify this pain providentially other than to say, what can I take from this? It's just, now I understand how people who go through this feel. And it means I'm more attuned to their sensitivities. All sorts of realms in life that one, if one has not experienced, one doesn't understand. Not because they're incapable of it, but because you haven't been awoken to that need. Fundamentally, we're all capable of the deepest empathy, but if we don't experience something, we're just not aware of the pain that's involved. Now, Shadal says that's the root of why we went to Egypt, and actually he says that's the root of what it is to be a servant of God and to be human. And he says there are a number of mitzvot. Mitzvot, last line of him, mitzvot harber, she'ena mechavanot la'atzman. There are many mitzvot, he says, which are not really about what you think they're about. There are a number of mitzvot which you think about me doing some ritual act. And he says, that's not at all what it's about. What is it all about? Ki'im l'tachlit zot. It is for this purpose, to make us empathetic. There are so many rules and laws and mitzvot and chukim and mishpatim. He says that on the surface seem pretty mundane, useless, redundant. This is that you're right. Essentially, it's not about the mitzvot themselves, but about how they turn you into empathetic people. That's his argument. We're running low on time, by which I mean we're out of time. So we'll finish quickly. Or we could just finish, but I guess we'll finish very quickly. The switch from the plural to the singular, that you, plural, shall not oppress the widow and the orphan. And then it goes, and if you oppress, singular, him or it, oto could be translated, singular, there'll be trouble. Why is the shift to the singular? We've just been told, don't hurt orphans or widows. And if you oppress him, why don't you just say otam? And if you oppress them? Yeah, that's the instinct. Empathetic. Yeah, so that's fantastic. These are the two views we have on the page before us, and there it kind of sums up the instincts of the number of the commentators. Though, im tane oto, if you oppress him, the suggestion it's actually... who do I have? The Kliyakar on the page, underneath where it says empathy. Oh, look, it's on the page, empathy. There you go. I put that there a couple of days ago. So the Kliyakar says that Oto actually is encoded to make you think of Hashem. That if you oppress him, which again is not the pshat, but it is a suggestion that if you harm these vulnerable people, you're actually, well, this is an unfortunate metaphor, but poking the bear. Meaning HaKadosh Baruch Hu is provoked. He is harmed. He is pained when you hurt these people. And if you do that, what's going to happen? What does the pasuk say? Ki im tane tane oto. And if you oppress them, oh my gosh, here it comes. What's the answer? There's no answer. Right? Meaning, I will listen to their cries. Okay. And what about me, right? And so you'll listen to their cries. Very nice. We often say that to people. Oh, I hear. And then you walk away. So what does it mean?
Hashem listened to our cries when we were slaves and took us out.
And then we saw what... Right. So, but it's all by implication. And the assumption is that it's so vast, the consequences, that really all you need is the rhetorical threat. If you dare harm these people, let that sit.
But it says...
In that pasuk? Yeah, but I left that off the page, so it doesn't exist. We're only putting one pasuk under pressure here. Okay. No, you're right, but the structure is very strange. And it's commented by, I think it's the Sforna of the Abarbanel, that the structure, imane tane oto, it should then say, read the pasuk, ani chara. V'chara api would make sense to be at that point in the pasuk. And it seems, if you harm these people, I will surely listen to their cries, would ordinarily be out of order. And the suggestion is that it's to set up that rhetorical force, that this is so deeply affecting on God that it's worth paying attention to. Now, the other suggestion that we heard from Sima is in the Bala Turim and others, that actually... This broad rule, don't oppress the orphans and the widows, this is not just about government policy. This isn't just don't institutionalize harm on these figures, but don't harm one. Im tane oto, if you harm a single, if you oppress or inflict pain on a single vulnerable person, it is problematic. Number one, that's why oto in the singular, because it's a group which... triggers for me at least the thought of that famous poem from the Shoah. First they came for the communists, and I didn't say anything, so I wasn't a communist, and they came for this, etc., etc. And I think it was Wiesel who said that if anybody's lack of freedom makes me less free. I can't remember the exact term, but that's the suggestion. You harm one, you are rippling through society harm. And he also points out that the shift to the singular in the verb of the afflictor, that if you singular harm people, is to say that if even one person in a culture is harming another, and others do nothing, you're all part of the problem. It's what people throw around today is you're complicit, right? Meaning silence is complicity. And his suggestion is, as a culture, as a society, you shall not oppress these people. And if you singular, if one person does it, I'm going to wreak havoc on the nation, because if one person does it and you do nothing, the whole culture is corrupt. That's a suggestion. We're going to finish now with the Baal HaTorim at the end. The doubling we'll finish with. It says, Imaneta ne, if you shall surely oppress, Sa'ak Yatsak, he will surely cry out, Shema Shema, I will surely hear. On one level, the suggestion is that actually, with each harm, one doesn't get a sense for how much pain one is causing. You say one thing to a person, and I'm sure many of us have had experience with this on either the receiving or the giving end, intentionally or unintentionally, that one says a word that triggers all sorts of associations for somebody, leads them to a place of despair and dullness, which makes them turn to somebody else and either pay forward that pain or draw them in to pastoral relationship that makes them part of the cloud. And it spreads. And that's what this doubling is. That's the suggestion of the Rabbeinu Bechaya. The Baal HaTorim says, actually, this is just a verbal instantiation of the mechanics of providence, that what you have done will be visited upon you. Just think of the parallel. Aner to aner, sa'ok yitzak, shema eshma. Understand that this is reciprocal. And what we'll do, mishpatim, there's obviously a huge amount more to say. We missed right at the end of the parasha. God is described as looking like something to the people. I'll leave you with that question. If you've got it, I'll answer it. What does God look like to the Jewish people at the end of the parasha? Oh, so that's interesting description of Shamayim. Right at the end, it says, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu seemed to the people as something. I'll leave that question with you. You find it out, you can come to me. In the meantime, we'll meet next week. Parashat Truma. Okay, good Shabbos.